Well, I'm back after 2 weeks away from the podcast, and my wife and I were traveling. We were on vacation for our anniversary, and then when we got back, we moved apartments. And then right after we moved apartments, I also moved into a new office slash studio space. So just to give you a behind-the-scenes look at how we do things in the Sugg household, we basically do a million stressful things all at once. That's how we tend to do it. So anyway, I'm really excited to be back after a little break. And this week's episode is really, really good. I had my friend Andy J. Pizza on the show. And Andy is an illustrator and a podcaster who's worked for gigantic brands like YouTube and the New York Times. And his podcast, Creative Pep Talk, is also heard by thousands and thousands of people every single week. And in this episode, we discuss neurodiversity and Andy's journey of learning how to work with his ADHD. We also talk about how to create more urgency and consistency in your life, how to face our shadow sides, and what makes a powerful story work. Here's our discussion. Andy, dude, thank you so much for being on the podcast today.
Alex, thank you for having me. It's good just to see your face and catch up, honestly.
I know. For listeners who don't know, Andy and I have a working history. I used to edit his podcast, Creative Pep Talk, which is incredible. We'll talk more about that in this episode. We also co-created an album of a soundtrack that went with that podcast. I don't know any other podcast out there that has its own soundtrack, but Creative Pep Talk does. And I'm very proud of that. And I've loved working with Andy in the past. So it's fun to have you on, man.
First, can I just say, yeah, I don't know any other podcast that has its own soundtrack. And this, not only that, the soundtrack is amazing. People catch me listening to it and they're like, you're listening to your own theme song. And I'm like, dude, I didn't make it though. Alex freaking crushed this. And I can't speak to this. So this is a really stupid thing to bring up, but I was going to a super special meeting in LA 2 years ago before the world, you know, turned into fire. And, I was pumping myself up by listening to my favorite track, Pencil in the Stone, and it felt so epic. But your music is magic, and I feel like it's such a good fit with everything, all the kinds of stories that I like to tell. So if I'm just plugging you, man, everybody go listen to the Creative Pep Talk soundtrack on wherever you get your music, because Alex crushed it, and it's great work music.
It was fun to work on. That was a past life. I haven't done music in a while. But every now and then I'll throw the CPT soundtrack on as well. It's good working music.
So, it really is.
Yeah. So, man, I'm excited to have you on. I think that there are so many things I want to talk about, but I do think that you've been somebody in my life, but also in your listeners' life and people who follow you, where you've been like very, very hyper consistent. Like, I don't know anybody who's doing content or who's in the content space who's been putting out as much content with as much workload in it as often as you. Like, you're a workhorse, and I got to see it firsthand, and I'll get into more details of what all that looks like down in the episode. But I think what's super interesting to me, and you've really started opening up more and more about this over the past couple of years, is your story with having ADHD. And I think I just find that really fascinating. And you and I had conversations when we were working on the show together. And I think you've talked about it on your podcast too, publicly, that you, in so many ways, the reason why you're so driven to be successful and work on your own terms is because of your attention and because of your ADHD. And so I'm curious, man, maybe just from the beginning, I want to talk about Creative Pep Talk. I want to talk about that work, but I really want to focus in on neurodiversity and ADHD and your story when it comes to how you've, I don't even want to say overcome, but so much as like absorbed what that is and made it part of who you are, instead of trying to, I don't know what the right term is, deny it or run from it or things like that, or accept it, things like that. So maybe, I don't know, when did you first start noticing that you had ADHD?
That's a really good question. And, you know, I don't think I've ever been asked that question. So when I started thinking about this, it occurred to me that the first time it crossed my mind was when I was in like first grade, And one of the kids that I related to the most, who was like always bouncing off the walls, and we were like making up crazy songs and just all this stuff. When I found out that he was on medicine for whatever his personality was, or like whatever this, you know, energy was, I remember thinking right then and there, like, I think I'm the same as this kid, which is a crazy thing, because it's a very, very grown up thought. And I didn't think, oh, I need medicine. I thought, it's weird that he's on medicine for being like this. Nobody's ever put me on medicine for this, you know, energy and all this stuff that I've got going on. And so I think that was the first time where I thought, I don't know what that is, but I think that I'm similar to that. And then, you know, in high school, honestly, I've talked about this pretty openly, but you know, I don't recommend this to anybody. I'm just being open and transparent that there was a few times where I recreationally took Adderall. And the funny thing is, I had all my friends would be like telling stories. I wasn't a good kid in high school. Okay. Let's just say that I've come a long way. I've grown up, but I'd have my friends,
man, we're in this together. It's the same story.
Yeah. Here. I'm not doing illegal things now, but I had all my friends tell stories about, man, I was up for like 24 hours and blah, blah, all this stuff. And honestly, the thing that it really did for me was it made me get my homework done in an efficient manner. Yeah. And I was like, huh, that's weird. Right. And it, you know, and so I'm not, you know, we can maybe get into this in a bit. I'm not currently on medication. I haven't traditionally handled my ADHD with medication, but that was the second time that I kind of really thought, and I've always thought I'm weird. I always thought I'm weird. Everybody that's around me has always noticed that. Sometimes weird is a compliment, sometimes it's not. But my whole life, I've been the goofy weirdo who, you know, loses things and, you know, misplaces and gets lost and just, you know, gets off track and procrastinates and is the class clown and all that kind of stuff. And so it was early on. And I think even in high school, when I'd had that experience, I talked to my parents about it. And, you know, honestly, I come from the Midwest. You know, I think that potentially even growing up in the Bible Belt religious kind of community, that they didn't really know what to do with mental health stuff. Mm. And they were, I think, a bit afraid or thinking this is going to be a crutch, or, you know, it's all the same reasons that people choose to suppress themselves. My favorite quote is, one of my favorite quotes of all time is the Joseph Campbell, "The cave you fear to enter holds the treasure you seek." Mm. And really what that's about, the cave you fear to enter, is your shadow self, what your shadow side is. And by the way, even I think that term scares religious people of like, whoa, the shadow, the dark side. No, we're not talking about the dark side. We're talking about the side of you that you have not explored because something about it scares you. And when it comes to mental health stuff, when it comes to neurodiversity, there is all of this trepidation around, if I get a diagnosis, is it going to be a crutch? If I get that, is it going to be something that holds me back? Or is it some box that I'm putting myself in? There's a huge laundry list of reasons why you don't go find out what's going on inside of you. And honestly, that is the antithesis of my life's work, because I really believe that you can't find the good stuff if you won't look at the bad stuff. You're just suppressing all of it. So yeah, that's when I started to suspect it, but it wasn't until my mid-20s that I actually talked to my doctor and got a diagnosis.
Gotcha. Yeah, I totally agree. I think the shadow self, the shadow side, that's a really good way of putting it. I've heard that term used a lot, and I fully agree. And that Joseph Campbell quote is like incredible. We should all have that tattooed on our heads or something.
Yeah.
So true, man.
It's my jam. And, you know, it reminds me of two different Megs in my life, which I'll explain what that means. My friend Meg Lewis, I asked her, she's someone who seems so in tune with who she is. She's an illustrator, comedian, designer. And, you know, I was interviewing her once and asking her, like, what's the first step that people can take to get a clue about who they are? And she said something that blew me away, which is, start with what you're insecure about. Start with what are the things that people have said that cut you really deep about who you are? Yeah. And I think that's so interesting, and it's so insightful, because our brains are like Teflon to compliments. They just slide right off of us, but they are Velcro. This is Richard Rohr talks about this, Velcro to the put downs. They are. And the reason is, I think evolutionarily, we are wired to make sure that we are being hypervigilant about not getting ostracized from the community. So when somebody says something like, hey, here's something about you that's not so great, you're like, whoa, I'm going to sear that into my brain and overcompensate. Right. But the truth is, almost anything that's different about you, anything that stands out, people are going to comment on. They're going to comment on it, good and bad, but you're going to remember the bad. And almost always, the other Meg, just to tie it full circle, the other Meg is from A Wrinkle in Time. And in A Wrinkle in Time, the guide gives her this gift, and she gives her the gift of her faults. And you're like, what? That sucks. That's a terrible gift. Why would you do that? And when, no spoiler alert, well, spoiler alert, it's, but you've had like what, like, you know, half a century to read this book or something. I don't know how long. But in the last battle, she thinks, what was the gift that I got? And she remembers like, oh, my faults. And as soon as she thought that, she could instantly list every fault. Why? Because we keep them close to us. There are things like impatience. But the opposite of impatience is efficiency or anger. But there's this other side to that anger, which is justice. And so, all these things that are perceived as weaknesses, all these things that you're suppressing about yourself in your shadow self, they also have pros. They're not just, they don't just have cons. And when you take them out and you go into that cave, you're going to see like, these are the essence of what makes you different. And what makes you different is what makes you valuable. It's just like a diamond. They're supposedly valuable because they're rare. And all the things that make you different, that's what makes you rare. That's what makes you valuable. So,
I love that. I love that. I do think that kind of leads to another question, like more specifically around your experience with ADHD. Is it ADHD or ADD, real quick?
Well, from what I know, and I'm not a scientist or a psychologist, but I'm pretty sure the term that's used today is ADHD, even when they don't mean hyperactive. That's just called inattentive ADHD. So yeah, ADHD is, I think, the proper terminology in 2021.
Gotcha. That makes sense. I do think with ADHD specifically, and I don't personally, I've wondered in the past if I have some form of it. I would say mine has never been hyperactive. I would say if you're an upper, I'm a downer. I've always been more on like the depressive side.
Yeah.
And that's been kind of my mental health struggle through my life is just battling depression. But I've wondered, I've had a lot of conversations, and that's a big reason why I actually wanted to talk to you is for whatever reason, this has kept coming up in friends and conversations I've had lately where a lot of times ADHD might lead into depressive thoughts because you can't finish things or you can't get things done or you feel like you can't do simple daily tasks. And there are lots of things that go into that. But one thing I want to ask you about is, ADD, I do feel like at a certain point, maybe it's just me and my upbringing, but it kind of minimized the feeling in a way that almost might make somebody who has it feel small or like it's a joke or something. I've heard people, say like, oh, don't worry, that's my ADD in a joking manner or whatever it is, or that's my OCD or whatever it is, when it's like used too loosely, that can be pretty hurtful, And I guess I want to tie this back into for people who don't have ADHD, I've heard you say that, this is a quote from you from a tweet that boredom feels like physical pain. And I've heard you say that in the past. Can you dive into what that means? Because I don't think people who don't struggle with this have a full picture of maybe what it feels like to have it. It could be you're just hyper, you're just crazy, off the walls type thing. But I don't think that's a fair assessment. What does it feel like to have ADHD?
That's such a good question. And I really appreciate that premise because, the reason why I started being so open about my ADHD is because I saw what happened in the world over the past decade in terms of the autistic spectrum and the awareness and people, people writing shows about it and telling that story and people getting aware of it. And it became less of a thing of, it's just like all of the terminology, like multiple personality disorder or bipolar, or all these things. There's a time and place where the culture that doesn't understand them uses them in a flippant manner, like they're a joke, like they're funny, like everybody's little bipolar. Mm-hmm. Everybody, oh, it's just my, you know, whatever it is. Oh, it's my OCD. And I think that it's, you know, I think that that can be really harmful. And I think the antidote to that is to get people to understand, what is this actually like? And so I just started to feel like, you know, I've talked at length about my relationship to my mom, or lack thereof relationship with my mom. And I don't know this for sure, but I have a huge suspicion that my mom has undiagnosed ADHD. And watching her grow up in her generation, again, in the Midwest, in a religious setting, especially as a woman with ADHD, just seeing the amount of shame that she has carried and the lack of understanding. And not only that, she just is, in pretty much all ways, I struggle to say it because it's my mom, but, you know, just failed over and over and over. And I think at age 18, my mom went through, was in the hospital. She had had this really severe drug addiction that probably triggered brain tumor and all these kind of things, really bad situation. And I think on a subconscious level, I realized that she had spent her whole life failing. And the reason was because she was trying to be something she wasn't. She was trying to, really hard, trying to be a regular secretary, trying to be a waitress, trying to be a stay-at-home mom, trying to do these things that were not within her skill set or ability. And I watched this person, and I think she probably has a lot of childhood trauma. She has all kinds of stuff going on that made her the person that she is. And it's not an excuse, but I did see this person who everyone that met her thought, you are brilliant. You are hilarious. You are creative. But all the results said something totally different. And then over time, there's just this animosity and shame towards this person, and just all of the, you know, if your mom could only just hold down a job, why can't she hold down a job? Why can't she just stick at what she's doing? Why can't she just be a stay-at-home mom? And I think at age 18, I just subconsciously realized, like, there is no plan B for me. There's no trying to be something that I'm not. The only possible chance that I have, I watched her. She wanted to succeed at regular things. She tried to hold down a job, but it was so boring to her. She could not physically make herself do it. And to everybody else in the world that doesn't understand ADHD, that just looks like a willpower problem. It looks like a character problem. It looks like you're lazy. When the truth is, if you dig into this, you understand, no, it's an executive function problem. ADHD people have an executive function problem, which just means that the analogy that I heard that I think sums it up best was from some, you know, ADHD article, was it's just like every person has a grown-up in their brain and a kid in their brain. The grown-up in the brain is the thing that says, we have to do these tasks. And the kid says, why? And they say, well, just because. The kid says, no. If you don't have a better answer for that than that, I'm not doing it. I will pull at, like, you know, I made this, my ADHD is on full display here as my tangents run amok, but I made this comic that I think explained ADHD for me, which is, you know, this accountant talking to an ADHD character, and they're like, okay, here's all the, you need to file all these forms to file your taxes. And the ADHD person's like, or what? What, why do I have to do, what happens if I don't do it? And he's like, well, you'll go to jail. And he's like, oh man, shoo. That was a close one. I almost did all that paperwork. Do you think I can bring these art supplies to jail? That's kind of how I feel about everything. That's the way it goes. And so, you know, all the language they had at their disposal, all their understanding at their disposal was that this person's lazy. This person has no character. This person, you know, whatever. When really, we don't get any dopamine hits from completing tasks that don't have a deeper purpose connected to what we're wanting to do on the planet, what lights us up, what fulfills us. And if you just tell us to just do it because you have to or because you're supposed to, we won't do it. If we do it, we're going to do it for a very short period of time, and eventually we're going to falter. And so I watched her do this, and I didn't even have words for it at the time. I just knew, like, I'm like her. I know I'm not going to be able to do, I have the same problems. And so what I'm going to try to do, my whole theory was, I'm going to try to work like a maniac to get in a situation where everything I have to do is also what I want to do. Because for whatever reason, I can only make myself do what I want to do for an extended periods of time. I don't remember at all what your question was, but I'm sure that was some kind of answer to it.
No, it's a great answer. I think for you, I mean, dig into it more. So for you, you say there's no plan B, and I'm sure that still stands to this day. What does that mean?
It means, so this is a story that is completely true, and it's going to sound flippant, and that's why I feel like it sounds insecure or insensitive, but it is not, because it was genuine. I remember when I was in high school, I remember I had, you know, kind of Peter Pan syndrome in that, like, I was so frightened of growing up. The thing that I remember, an anxiety that plagued me all the time, which was like, just questions like, how do you remember to have Band-Aids in your house? Like, that's the level of maintenance and memory and togetherness and organization that a grown-up needs to have. Not to mention that I was just frightened of any type of traditional employment. You know, you should go look at the numbers of entrepreneurs. ADHD is overrepresented in that, because we don't want to be locked in a box. I do not want to be told, stand here for 8 hours. And I'm like, dear God, I'm going to combust. I really did. My parents, you know, I have these very mixed feelings about this, because I actually think a lot of my drive comes from the fact that my dad and my stepmom, who are not ADHD, who especially at the time didn't have compassion for it, because they just didn't understand it at all, forced me to have a job from when I was 14. And I have mixed feelings about it, because I think that this is where my drive came from, is just going to work, standing in this, you know, I worked at a movie theater. I worked at Subway. I worked at all these places that go stand there for 8 hours. And by the time I was done, I would be nauseous every day, every time, nauseous. I'm like shaking because I'm so miserable. And so the reason I'm grateful for that is I do think that that's where my drive came from. It's like, I have to at all costs avoid this. And when I was in high school, I remember actually kind of, you know, I wouldn't call it subconscious because I was aware of it, but I wasn't consciously thinking this, but it was in my head of thinking. I also thought about going into acting, and I ended up choosing illustration as my path. But I thought, you know, I'm pretty good at acting. I was doing plays and stuff. And I thought, worst case scenario, I can fake mental illness and I can go live in an institution and I can just do whatever I want in that. And that, obviously, it's very insensitive and it's also immature in so many ways. But that was how desperate I was. That's why I tell the story, is that was a real thought. That I know it sounds so ridiculous, but I remember thinking, like, I've got to have what if I can't make it doing the things that I want? And those were my dark thoughts, was I'll just like, yeah, I'll just, you know, I'll just go get taken care of somewhere because I cannot go sit in a cubicle. I knew that. I watched my mom, because you know what? I've watched my mom. She chose a worse and worse and worse life until she just, you know, she runs on the bare minimum, you know, barely getting by, but not having to go do those things. And so, yeah, that's what it was like.
Mm. Yeah. Man, I hear that. And I think it's just so interesting. I've heard you talk about Subway being a sandwich artist, and even there, like, well, what was that like? Cause I remember you talked about it. Maybe tell the story of what it was like to be a Subway.
Yeah. I always say, you know, I went to college for art and I went straight into professional art right out of school. It wasn't the medium of my choice. The medium was sandwiches, because I was a sandwich artist. And they really should not call it that, because if I ever got too artistic with the sauces, I was very reprimanded quickly. Like, I used to like sign my name in the sauce and they're like, 3 lines, Andy, 1, 2, 3, line. And so, and you know what's funny? We've talked about my obsession with analogies. And I actually think my obsession with analogy has everything to do with being understood. Communicating, trying to say, I know you don't know what this experience is like. I know you don't know what it's like, but it's kind of like this. You know that thing? We both know that thing. It's like that. And so when I was working at Subway, there was one time, like, I had spent, this is probably like 6 years into having part-time jobs. And my dad came and met me for lunch. And I remember, I don't remember the analogy I told him, but I was like, Dad, I'm not a mess because I'm lazy. I'm not like making up that I feel nauseous in this work. And I told him some analogy and I just saw a light bulb go off. And it was this, it was the feeling of connection in a way that I had never felt so seen and understood. And I have this giant mission in life, which is about around neurodiversity. And it's just this idea that there's one of the most toxic ideas on the planet to me is that we're all more or less the same. That is just the most toxic idea and has done so much damage in my life. And so many mentors, guides, teachers, people in my life have at times given me advice that where the underpinning philosophy is we're all the same. And if you're struggling, it's because you're not trying hard enough. And I remember my dad who more or less in terms of work, just totally crushed life. He is, right. You know, he could not be more successful at work. He's an accountant, finance. He's a finance master. He's always crushed work. He's always had that. And I watched this analogy just make it all make sense to him. And I saw compassion in his eyes for me for the first time. And I also think that it helped him maybe think a little bit differently about his ex-wife. Now, she had all kinds of other problems, but I do think it was like, okay. And so that's Subway, I worked at Subway for several years in college. And when I got out of school, I'd actually put all my eggs in the basket of illustration. I was doing design at school. And so after I got out of school, I couldn't get a job for a long time. A lot of my friends who were really talented were getting these really cool jobs. And I was working at Subway. And I did that for months after I graduated. And I would go home. I lived in England at the time. And I would go home on the bus and I would just plead with the universe. I would have like a 40-minute bus ride home and I would just beg the entire time, please get me out of this. And I would literally just wrestle with the universe the whole way home of, I cannot do this with my life. If this is what's ahead of me, if this is where the yellow brick road is going, I don't want to go there. And that is about it's just 2 degrees away from the darkest thoughts you can have. And so, that's kind of what that period of time was like. And it sucks. And I just want to highlight something. I tell this story. Everybody can tell that I mean it, that I'm emotional about it. And it's in the shame of it is after I tell that story, I have to feel the shame of, you worked at Subway, you idiot. That's not an obstacle. That's not a struggle. Why is that so hard for you? And that's the shame of ADHD.
Yeah, I think it's so interesting because you're right. I'm sure a lot of people would say like, it's Subway. What's the big deal? It's Subway, you know, but if you flip-flop that, it is like almost the biggest deal. If you feel like if this is my life, I cannot go forward because I can't live this way. I can't go to work sick every day, wasting the precious moments of we're all going to die.
Yes.
We have these very precious moments and every moment should be seen as precious. And if you're getting reprimanded for having fun with the sauce on a stupid sandwich, like you can't even find any simple joy or what, like to me, it's just, you know, someone who doesn't understand could see it as like, come on, get over it. It's not a big deal. But if you're the one in it, it feels like the end of the world. And there's just no denying that.
And I look around and all the first level jobs of everything that I did at the movie theater and at Subway and the few other jobs in between, I not only was I just desperately struggling and hated every second of it, but I'm looking around at everybody just doing it with ease. Just like nobody's like having very few people are like, this is amazing, but nobody's losing money from the cash register because they can't pay attention. I did that all the way through all jobs.
Right.
Because I could do the math. I had decent math grades, honestly. Mm-hmm. But until it required me to study, I had great math grades. But, you know, but yeah, and the shame of that and thinking like, I can't even do the most basic job. Like I remember telling my dad that and yeah, and just feeling all the shame in the world and doom, just what's going to happen to me?
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. I have a really good friend who recently we've been talking about ADHD, and he, one if not two of his kids were diagnosed with it. And the family psychologist who's working with him basically said, there's a chance one of you has it too, talking to him and his wife, the parents.
Yeah.
And he's had lots of, you know, ups and downs with depression through the years. And he almost felt like some light bulb went off for him because he realized that, oh, maybe it's not that I'm depressed first. Maybe it's this ADHD thing from the beginning, because he's felt the sense of doom, or he can't finish simple tasks throughout the day, or he loses the cash at the cash register type situation. And for him, it's so interesting because I think he's felt like that doom has been lifted a little bit because he now has hope of like, okay, I'm actually working and diagnosed in the correct area of my life. And there's something real I can work toward. But the word you keep bringing up is shame. And he described to me that and he has a religious background. There's so much shame that can come from that in and of itself. But he just felt the shame as a person, as a husband, as a father, that like he couldn't finish simple tasks, or he couldn't do A, B, and C that made him feel whatever way. And that's the word he kept using as well. So shame, I mean, I know it's sensitive, but I'm curious, what does shame mean to you? What has that felt like to you? How does that manifest in your life, or how had it in the past when you felt it more?
I feel it all the time. Here's the thing. One way of describing what happens in an ADHD brain and how it works is they really struggle to do things they don't want to do, that they don't feel like doing, that they don't find that. And another way of saying that, other than ADHD, in terms of the eyes of culture and history, is just a bad person. This person doesn't do what he doesn't want to do. Sounds like a terrible person. Sounds like a terrible father. Sounds like, you know, and I think that what happened with, you know, my mom, you know, every person in the family just never, ever, my whole childhood, never stopped talking about more or less how much of a terrible person my mom is. And I think that, you know, and I grew up with that narrative of she can't keep a job. And then at some point, you know, you start getting new information about your family. You know, as you grow up, you start hearing the real stories and all that kind of stuff. And I never felt more compassion or more seen than when I heard someone tell the story of like, you know, all I heard was like, your mom can't even be a waitress. What the hell's wrong with her? When in reality, you know, later on when I was working through this, I don't know if my dad told me this as I was kind of working through ADHD stuff or what, but I find out that, you know, yeah, she had tried to be a waitress and she couldn't do the change on the fly. And she was so overwhelmed with shame by how stupid she felt because she couldn't keep track of all the money and all the details and all the stuff that she walked out. And so I was told this story of, oh, she's lazy. That's why she can't commit to anything. She doesn't have character. No, she was overwhelmed with shame. And every single night when I worked at the movie theater, that my boss would count down the drawer and say, well, let's see how it goes this night. And be like, oh, 26, 32 is missing somehow. And I would, do you know what that feels like? And not to mention that every single day I go in there, I'm thinking of strategies on how to get through it better. Strategies, how to do better, how to not lose money. I'm willing myself. How do I stay more present in this moment? How do I pay attention? How do I make sure I do every transaction? Still $11 off somehow. And so I think that what happens with a diagnosis is part of it is it does erase some of the shame because I realize like there is no changing this about myself. And when you can't change the obstacle, when you can't go through it, then you start thinking, okay, there is no moving that mountain. How am I going to get around it? And so when it comes to parenting, for instance, there seems to be two options to be present with your kids. So you either don't do it or you do what, do it. Those are it. That's the only two things. You either do what they, spend time with them the way that they want to spend time with you, or you don't. And a lot of parents pick one or the other of those. But when I realize, like, it's not a long-term solution ever for me to do things that I really don't want to do, not just despise to do, just that just seem boring to me. I realize that I have to prioritize what are the things with each three of my kids individually that they like to do and that I love, that they love to do and that I love to do.
Yeah.
And then that strategy comes from not thinking, oh, I'm going to psych myself up and be the father that, you know, that I've never been today. No, it's a reality check of saying, you're not going to do that. It's not going to happen. You might be able to do it for 5-10 minutes, willpower your way through that. After that, you're done. You're checking out. You're not going to be present. Doesn't even matter if you force yourself to sit there. You're not going to be there mentally. But the shame that comes with thinking like, yeah, there are things that my kids want me to do that I'm not saying I don't ever, there are things, you know, there are parent teacher conferences and I go there and I'm dreading it. I'm like, oh my God, I'm going to have to sit there for an hour. I'm going to have to sit there for an hour. They're going to go through bureaucracy and details and I'm going to be freaking trembling in my seat with like, I have to get out of here. And I do. And I do. Yeah. Those things that I have to do, I do them. But if I ever have a choice, I'm always looking for the thing that's compatible with the ADHD. What are the things I have in common with them? Yeah. So that's how the shame manifests and how it's forever ongoing.
Right. Well, that's how my friend described it. He felt like instead of it being like a character flaw, which is what he's felt like his whole life, is like there's just something wrong with me and I'm just a bad, you know, it manifests in language like I'm just a bad person or a bad father or whatever it might look like, when it's like, nope. You just have some pipes that are wrong in your brain. There's like, there's practical ways to try and maneuver around them or to treat it, whatever it looks like. And that in and of itself has been really freeing, a really freeing experience to be like, oh, so I'm not just like this horrible person where I've had this narrative in my head for however many years about myself. Yeah. I think that's really, really interesting.
Can I want to just tell a story I made up that I feel like illustrates this thought, because it's not even like you're saying, your friend saying, I don't even know if it's a disorder. I don't really get into the weeds of, is it a disorder? Is it not a disorder in terms of, is it a bad thing or is it a good thing? Sure. I'm not really, you know, I don't really care if it's a disorder or not. It is a fact that people have different types of brains. This is a type of brain that they've observed. They know that it's a common thing. It's in something like 5-10% of the community, you know, in the population. And we know this brain works differently. Now, some people have theories around how maybe it has to, that this was an evolution that happened in certain hunter gatherers where they are very good at, this brain would be very, a massive advantage in a hunting situation where you are not, you know, one of the misconceptions of ADD is that you can't pay attention to anything, when the truth is you're paying attention to everything. You can't filter the focus. Right. Everything is on your radar. That's really good for a hunter. Also really good for a hunter is project-based work where you're like, I'm all in, hyper-focus, all the attention everywhere, deep connection to the meaning of what I'm doing. Like ADHD people make terrible farmers because it's like, okay, today I plant so that a year later I have a crop. You're like, what? That's just not the, you know, the pipeline of meaning is just not close enough for me. Right. So, the amazing hunters. Anyway, the reason I wanted to tell you this story is because when it comes to you saying you're, you know, some pipes in your brain are weird, you know, that's kind of how it goes. Have you ever heard me tell a story about the alien?
No.
Okay. So this is the way I like to think about it. When you talk about neurodiversity, when you talk about why I believe everybody should dedicate half of their life to finding out what the heck is going on inside of you. What is different about your DNA? What's different about your brain? Because here's the thing, man. Yes, we've talked a lot about all of the ways that ADHD makes you bad at regular things, but it also makes you amazing at super irregular things. It really does. It makes your brain is a powerhouse in all these ways that normal brains aren't. Whatever, and I'm not sure if there are normal brains. And this is why when I talk about neurodiversity, I'm talking to everybody. Everybody, take the don't do the 30 minutes at the high school guidance counselor to figure out what is special about me. You are something the world has never seen. So here's my alien story. I have this picture of like, you're sitting there on the couch eating Cheetos or something, and a wormhole pops up and this alien appears out of the wormhole, and he's got this crazy device. And he's like, listen, I need to tell you three things about this alien device. Number one, this alien device is unique in all the universe. Number two, inside this thing contains the known universe's most complex inner machinery. There's nothing in the world that is as complex as this. And then number three, I'm going to tell you what it does. And then before he can tell you number three, an evil alien with like evil alien eyes pops out of the wormhole and blasts him and kills him before he can tell you what this thing is for. And if you had a thing that had that was unique in all of the universe, that was contained the known universe's most complex inner machinery, you'd spend the rest of your life figuring out number three. What is this thing for? What is this thing capable of? And obviously, everybody knows you are the device. That device is in your head. It's your neurodiversity. There is nothing in the known universe that is as complicated as your brain. That is a fact. And there's nothing in the universe ever, and there never will be, that has the DNA that you have.
Sure.
Why don't we spend any significant amount of time asking the question, who am I? We don't. When someone says, find yourself, we instantly write it off as like new age bullshit. Like, okay, right. Cool. Yeah, find yourself, whatever. No, I've been on, because of thinking I will not succeed by trying to be something I'm not. I have spent a decade trying to figure out, what are the strengths and weaknesses? What is the special stuff that's going on that I have that other people don't have? And it's completely invisible. It requires an insane amount of effort, trials, errors, tests, projects, all that stuff to figure out what is going on in here. What do I have actual advantages in? What do I have significant weaknesses in? That's a huge part of my podcast. It's a huge part of all the work I do, is I want to rail against the lie that we're more or less the same inside.
Right.
And I want to enter that cave and spend a hell of a long time trying to slay that dragon of, you know, the mystery of who am I?
Yeah, totally. I think what you're describing, and I think you're a great example of this when you talk about it, but what I'm sensing from you is, you know, you've, in so many ways, what you're saying is what makes each individual person different can be turned into your superpower.
Yes.
There's certainly faults, and there are certainly things that are difficult about it. You're going to hit walls. It's going to be tough for whatever my stuff is versus your stuff versus everyone else's stuff as individuals. But what's cool about what you're talking about is the pain you've gone through to figure this out. It's to me, I wrote it down just now. It's like this beautiful example of urgency, like life urgency. And I think for me, you know, I think the past year and a half, it's been just like this dumpster fire of insane events that have gone on, you know, both just in our country, but across the world in so many ways, shapes and forms. We don't have to talk about that. Everyone's talking about that. But I do think for me, like one thing it's really spurred is this. You know, I mentioned it earlier, we're all going to die someday.
Yep.
And what you're describing is the work, you know, you're almost inspiring me as we're talking, of like, you are thinking the thoughts that I imagine most people think on their deathbeds, of like, I cannot live this way. And it's almost like the regret, you're almost regretting the future before it happens. And so you're able to make those choices before. It's like a pre-decision decision almost, where you're deciding before you even get there, I'm not freaking going there, or I am going to bravely enter this scary cave. How, I think that there's something when it comes to this example of urgency. Do you find that, you know, in your day to day, what is that urgency like? Like when you wake up in the morning and you have the parent teacher conference, or you just have work to do and you don't feel like doing it? Because that's one thing about you, and I did want to get to this, and I guess it's as good a time as any right now, is like, you as an individual, as Andy, you are a hyper consistent deliverer of work and good work. And, you know, I don't think people understand when they listen to Creative Pep Talk, I've been impressed for a long time, because you're literally, you know, you do bi-weekly. So 1 week it's just you talking like a monologue. Then the other week it's an interview. I think you're still doing it in that format for the part.
It's usually two monologues to an interview, but it's pretty similar to that. Yeah.
Gotcha.
Yep.
That's insane that you do the, and these are 45 hour long monologues. You're basically doing a keynote speech two or three times a month for free. Yeah. And then you know, for the world to listen to. And I know you have patrons, you have all this other stuff going on, but you have that on top of crazy illustration work you're doing for all these clients. And so for me, and you've done this for how many, you've hit
over 6 years. Yeah.
Yeah. It's just like, so as it's very interesting to me that as somebody who, you know, you're for traditionally maybe thought of, it's difficult to focus on things. You have found how, like, what to focus on, and it's like you can't stop focusing on it or something. Like, talk about that. You kind of found your sweet spot, and now it's just like you're a powerhouse in a certain sense where you're just like delivering really consistently. Like, and I don't know many times you've missed a week or, you know, missed a whatever. I just feel like it's been pretty consistent for 6 years, which is really hard to do.
Yeah. Yeah, I want to speak to both those things, the urgency and the consistency. But I first just want to say thanks, man, because, you know, I try really hard, especially on the monologue or on both monologues and interviews, to hide the seams. I think there's nothing kind of more like, I never watch Revenant. But I never wanted to watch it because I know
everyone's just like, oh, it was really cold.
Yeah. It's like, I don't know how enjoyable it is to consume something. We're like, man, they worked hard on this. You're like, okay, that's like making me lose, you know, suspension of disbelief, or it kind of kills the magic a little bit when you're like,
I 100% agree.
You know what I mean? And so I appreciate when anyone notices, like, there's no way this guy is like, no, people don't know when I do a monologue, that's like 15 pages of notes. They don't know that. Like in my notes phone, that's all. And not to mention that I've usually recorded to get one episode. I've usually recorded three to get there. Like it's a long process. And I've studied a lot about storytelling and analogies and structure and all kinds. And it's just a bunch of stuff. So anybody that picks up on like, hey, this thing he's doing is pretty weird. I can't, you know, that I feel very seen and I really appreciate it. But first I'll talk about the urgency thing, and then I'll talk about woodchucks, which are what we'll talk about when I talk about the consistency thing. But on the urgency thing, there's a few parts to that that I think are really key, because I do think, you know, one of the things that really drives me bonkers is just apathy and pure nihilism. You know, one of my favorite things ever, there's a book by Lulu Miller. I feel like there's a truth in this that I'm going to just start telling people, even though it's a big part of the book, because it's such a good thing. It doesn't matter that, yes, it's kind of a spoiler. Maybe people don't feel like that, but it's a fact of life. That's a philosophical idea that I carry with me all the time. And Lulu Miller wrote the book. I think it's called Fish Don't Exist. And ultimately the book is about, you know, this person trying to find meaning in life and whether we matter, and kind of facing nihilism or, you know, all the just pure apathy. And she ends up deciding that we absolutely, without a doubt, matter beyond any, there's no debating it. It's a fact, because at the very least, we matter to each other. Mm. We matter to each other. So we matter. And we might matter more than that. I actually think we do. But at the very least, what you do matters. And the fact that we walk around every day acting like we don't, playing it cool, it drives me absolutely insane. The amount of apathy and cool that people show up to the day with. And the reason I think that is I really do think this is the gift that my mom gave me, is that I've seen her decisions all throughout her life ripple out through eternity. My wife's life is worse because because my mom's not in her life. Mm. They would have had an amazing relationship. Mm. They have so much in common. My wife feels less belonging in my family because of her decisions. Mm. And that's 40 years, you know, 30 years later.
Right.
Pick all the other ones. What about her grandkids? What about me when I was seven? Like, wait, like, the ripples of your decisions and choices are so huge, and nobody wants to sit in that for very long. And I think we need to sit in it every day. We need to, you know, for me personally, that experience, I've talked about it like this in the past. When that was happening, there were so many days as a kid. I was a mama's boy. I was a mama's boy, and I wanted my mom. And there were so many days and nights as a kid and a teen just crying my eyes out because she didn't show up or this thing happened or what, you know, all these things. And it feels literally like someone's digging a hole into your heart, right? And as I grew up, I realized that this hole is a well. That well is the well of passion. That is the well of intensity. That is the well of urgency. And you see it also, I will never make a mark like Jim Henson and Alexander Hamilton, but one word that they describes both of them, that people around them described them as, was urgency. When Jim Henson's brother died, boom, overnight, he was making stuff like it was his last day. And in that Hamilton thing, that's in the play, they talk about, why do you write like you're running out of time? Because you are. We're all running out of time, and all the decisions we're making, I know it's heavy, but they matter. And you're not going to do it perfectly, but if you will show up, if you will keep that top of mind, I do believe you'll make better decisions, and you will be less full of regret on your deathbed. Mm. And when it comes to consistency, it's linked to that. I mentioned the woodchuck thing, you know. Jerry Seinfeld talks about, you know, just find out what kind of chuck you are. What do you chuck? He chucks jokes. He's a joke machine. That's what I'm talking about when I talk about self-knowledge is, what's this computer's functions? You throw this thing in, it pops this thing out. For me, that's storytelling. Story, and this is a huge debate that we could go into, but to me, all good stories are essentially analogies. They're just saying, you know, I subscribe to the kind of school of thought from Brian McDonald. He wrote a book called Invisible Ink. He has a podcast called You Are a Storyteller. It's on our network. And he's a story expert who's consulted with Pixar and Disney. And he's sold a movie to HBO, and he's done all kinds of different things. He's working on really cool stuff. But his whole thing is that, you know, stories are our way of passing on survival information. And when he says survival information, he doesn't just mean like life or death. He means emotional survival, spiritual survival, social survival. There's all these different, and you know, surviving to thriving, like the hierarchy of needs. Like when we tell stories, why we've told stories in every culture of all time is because the way I describe it is they take truth from our head to our heart. If I tell you, and I'm going to get back to why the heck I'm talking about story in one second, because I do believe I'm a story chuck. That's what I chuck. And the reason I am is because at the bottom of story is truth. And that's just something, I think there's an ADHD thing that says, why? If you tell me to do this, tell me if I'm learning guitar and somebody says, learn these three chords. And I say, why? Why do I want to learn these three chords? I can't learn them if you don't tell me what song I'm going to play. Right. And I have to know why I want to play that song. Why? My brain just automatically goes to the bottom layer of why on everything. Yeah. And so I always come across just naturally, just these little nuggets of things that I'm like, oh, that's doing it for me. That why is motivating me. And then I tell a story about how to make you feel that truth. And that's what my brain does. Anyway, real quick aside on story, if I told you that, you know, the journey of life isn't to find something you don't have. It's to find something you already have. If I told you that, you're like, okay, yeah, maybe that's true. But if I said, yeah, that's the point of Wizard of Oz, all of a sudden you're feeling it. You didn't just cognitively think, oh, that kind of seems true. You felt it. The journey wasn't a waste because she had the ruby red slippers the whole time. She had to figure out what she had. She had to understand that home is where she needed to be all along. That the whole way through, the journey was to find that they already had the brain, the heart, and the bravery. Like, that story makes you feel a truth. Anyway, I'm digressing like crazy, but my point is that when it comes to consistency, It is all just about finding what kind of Chuck are you? Mm. I am the person who I don't have to try. I'm obsessed with finding your automatic behaviors. What are your automatic functions of your brain that you do? My buddy, Kyle Sheely, who I just made this kids book with, his brain automatically takes everything literally. We rewrote a book called A Pizza with Everything on it. And his brain says everything in the universe. It has everything. And that's the story he tells. But that's how his brain always works. And it takes so long to pick up on these natural things because to you, it's like a fish in water. Like, you don't know that there's water. This is just everything that surrounds you. This is just your experience. And so it is a huge journey to figure out what are the things that I just do automatically. For me, automatically, I am pursuing a creative career. I'm trying to thrive as a creative. And all along the way, I'm trying to get to the bottom of just naturally, what are the core values? What are the core practices? Why? And then another function that I can do is I really am obsessed with explaining it to other people. I want to see them have the light bulb moment. And I want them not to just think it. I want them to feel it like I feel it. And so I want to tell stories. So those two things are things that I automatically do, which means when I do take weeks off, now we have it, we've scheduled the podcast to make my life more sane. Every sixth week we take off in a year. Yeah. And when I take that week off, I am like dying to go back and do it again. Mm-hmm. And there are times where I'm tired and I don't want to show up. There are times when I record an episode where I've committed to do it for the sponsors. And I'm just like, and I might have something to say, but I'm just like pulling my hair out because just, you know, I'm moody. I'm a human person or whatever. Yeah. But ultimately the reason I've been able to show up and do it for 6 years is because this is the kind of stuff that I chuck. And when you find that, and that's just like Alexander Hamilton writing, like that's why he outwrote everybody else around him and all the other, you know, founding fathers, because that was just, he found what he does and he plugged it in and the rest is history.
Yeah. I'm thinking of people listening who, you know, for you, you found illustration and you found story and you found these things that were just very, you know, storytelling analogies. They are just hearing you talk. They are just natural to you. Yeah. These things come, you know, like I think I quote this probably half of the podcast episodes, but there's this Naval Ravikant quote where find what feels like play to you and work to others. And that's how you will succeed in life. And I love that quote, but I'm curious, like, are there practical things someone can do in your opinion to go find those things? Cause I know, you know, for there's also this, you know, I don't even love using the term creative as a creative because a lot of times that pigeonholes people into you should be a filmmaker or an artist or whatever, but it's like all of life can be creative. You don't have to be in one of these, you know, distinctly whatever we've characterized as a creative job necessarily to have a creative life.
I agree.
So maybe like say someone's like an accountant right now out there and they're unhappy, but they don't might know where those passions lie. Like for you, like what steps would you tell them? Like, hey, go digging or go walk into the cave. Like what is maybe more practically, what does that look like in your opinion?
That's great. The first one we talked about already is, you know, if you have some suspicions, talk to a professional. Talk to a professional that, like, I'm a big believer in therapy. I think that therapy has pros and cons. I think that's for sure. There's all kinds of things that I think you should approach it with caution. You should approach it. You should look around and make sure you get a good fit. But if you have these suspicions of things that you're struggling with, I suggest doing the same thing Meg talks about. Start with what's wrong with you? What do you think is what's wrong with you? Because the fact of the matter is one of the reasons that I'm going to give you another thing too, but that's the first thing. And when it comes to ADHD, ADHD is so big picture. It's so, you know, 20,000 foot view. Like does not care about the details, right? Like, you know, if it starts with, I ignore all details. Yeah, well, the flip side of that is I take in the big picture like nobody else. I get the big picture every time, always. When I watch a movie, often I'll watch a movie, you know, I find it pretty easy to find when a movie has a point. Usually it's not obvious to most people. Like if you go, one that I was kind of dissecting recently, one of my all-time favorites, Toy Story 3. Like Toy Story 3, the point of that movie is we'll be fine if we stick together. That's the point of it. And the opposite, the villain is saying, you'll be fine if you take care of yourself. Wow. So there's always, and the story proves that point. That's the big picture. And for a lot of people, that's what Brian calls invisible ink. That's the invisible stuff. But because I'm not in the weeds of the details, I'm taking in the big picture all the time. So the first thing I do is go figure out what are the things that you're terrible at. Another example, I'll give you an example, an illustration. When I was just starting out, I had an art director when I was living in England. We were out for a drink and I'd worked with him a few times, him and a few other friends. And he, you know, we've had a few drinks and he says something like, yeah, you know, Andy, I always call you when I just need to fill the page. When I just need, you know, no white space, corner to corner, just, you know, no subtlety. And I just, and that was one of those times it just stuck to me like Velcro of like, I have no subtlety. I have no nuance. I have, you know, and, but the opposite of subtlety is attention grabbing. It's right. Huge, energetic, explosive. Do you know how many brands have wanted that from me?
Right.
And how much better it has been when I've leaned into that.
Right.
And so start with practically start with the things that you're insecure about and then go do the tests about it. Go do the talks with professionals. Go get to the bottom of what are the words associated with these problems and start getting some language around it, because almost all those things have a flip side. They have an upside. You just you've just been Teflon to those. Those things have just all the good parts of it that you just haven't, you haven't been intentional about holding on to the good, and the bad just sticks to you like glue. So that's the first thing. The second thing that I think you should do is just go try things. And that sounds cliche, but I want to just say illustration. Everyone thinks illustration is drawing, but if it was drawing, we would call it drawing. Why does it have another word? Because it's not drawing. Illustration to me is writing with pictures. I don't even like drawing that much. Drawing, I think, was a coping mechanism for me, like a meditation practice to chill the F out as a kid. Like my parents loved that I picked up drawing because I would go into my room and shut up for hours. It was a coping mechanism, right? I'm not someone who brings my sketchbook around and is just constantly, oh, I've got to capture that. No, that's not what I do. I'm an illustrator. I am interested in writing. I want to write with pictures and I want to write with words. And the reason I say that is because I didn't know that until I was 5 or 6 years into my illustration practice. And the point of that is, I always say it this way, Superman doesn't learn to fly sat on the couch thinking, what can I do? What's special about me? He does it by going to try kicking bad guys' asses and he falls off the building. He figured it out through failure. He figured it out in the world, trying things. I'm an illustrator, but I'm not an illustrator in any way that people think. I think that an illustrator, everyone thinks, oh, you must be crazy about drawing. I don't actually care that much about pictures. I care about how their ability to illustrate a point. That same reason I'm a storyteller. Pictures are one of the ways that I've got people to look at my stories.
Sure.
Right? But I only figured all that out almost a decade into my practice, man. So that is, you know, falling off so many buildings. So yes, start with your faults, start with your good guesses, get your hands dirty, fall off some buildings, and all along the way, you know, the third, I'll give you 3 points, very wrapped up nicely in a bow. The third thing is, everybody has this, we have a really binary brain that wants to say it's yes or no. It's almost never either of those. It's almost never two options. There's 256 colors on the spectrum. There's, you know, it's just, that's life. Okay. So when it comes to, so I gotta reverse back a second, cause I got so excited about 256 colors that I totally derailed myself. But, this is what I was saying. We all want to think it's binary. Everybody tells you that there's two pieces of advice and they're both wrong and they're both right. Either grit, just pick something and never give up. The people that succeed, they just grit their way 10,000 hours. They just don't forget if you're good at it. Forget if it's your thing. Forget. Just keep going. You know, we've seen those people trying out for American Idol.
Right.
That cannot sing, but right. they got grit, man. And everyone pities their grit. Sure. Right. And so we either think it's grit or we think it's pivot, fail fast. Just, right. you know, all the time. And I have I always think of it like, let's integrate it as a kind of narrative framework. It's not grit or pivot. It's both. And yeah. so one of the ways that I practically recommend people doing this, start with your faults, develop something where you can start falling off buildings, develop a project, which is a hypothesis of saying, I think it's, you know, when I thought it was making book covers, I made a project around it. When I thought it was editorial illustration, I made a project around it. When I thought it was public speaking, I made the podcast. Like, make a project where you can make some mistakes and test it out and get your hands dirty yeah. and build in grit and pivoting. So grit saying, this is the best guess I have, but in order to really know if it's anything, I have to treat it like a scientist would. I have to collect enough data and create enough controls that tell me whether I'm really onto something. And I need a stopping point that says, when I get here, I will pivot. Right. It might be a huge pivot. It might be a tiny pivot, but I will pivot. And so when it looked like things like doing, when I thought I was going to do illustrating book covers, I thought I'm going to make 5 book covers for books in the public domain, and I'm going to reinvent them, and I'm going to make screen printed posters out of them. And I did, I started working, I started putting them out there. I was feeling really good about it. And this is a bit of data. The data you find might be the most obvious thing to everybody else, but until you get your hands dirty, you don't see it. So I'm putting them out in the world. I'm telling people about them. I'm putting them on social media. I put Moby Dick out there and someone tweeted to me, oh man, this is sweet. How did you like the book? And I was like, I don't really read fiction. And I'm like, it took me 3 posters in screen prints to realize like, oh, this is a terrible idea. This isn't my zone of genius. What the heck am I doing? And then when it came to podcasts, by the time I got to starting the podcast, I'd already made a lot of progress in like knowing a bit about who I am and what I'm capable of. And I thought, I really think I want to be a public speaker as a huge part of my business because I really love it. And I think I'm good at it. I think this is the kind of Chuck that I am. And I thought, okay, to really give that a shot, I need to make 100 episodes. Even if it's, you know, just me and a friend listening, I need to make 100 episodes to give it enough time to know if I'm good at it. And if people are agreeing, people are like, yeah, this is good. You know, and I'm so glad I did because after, you know, that's 2 years of making the show every week. And I made it easy. It was so easy in the beginning because I was just doing it so casually and I was just rolling with it, learning as I went, doing the minimal viable product thing. And you know, after the first year, almost no one was listening. But what I was doing was I was collecting not just quantitative data, but qualitative. Because when you start something, okay, I wish I could just, if I had a billboard, you know, the Tim Ferriss question. If I had a billboard, what I would say is like, quit trying to go viral, or viral is meaningless. Viral is a particular type of content that works well online. All of your favorite albums would never go viral.
Yeah.
They would never go viral. They wouldn't. Think of your favorite song of all time. Actually, that going viral is impossible. No song goes viral. If it does, anyway, my point is that I'm going back to the billboard. I'm trying to remember, what was I talking about? This is
virality. Why that would be the thing you put up there.
Yeah, I put it up there because as I'm making the podcast, I'm taking in not just quantitative data. Everybody, when they make projects and they're grading them and they're trying to figure out, am I onto something? They always look at the numbers. But numbers are a weird game. It's literally like starting a business and expecting to hit the lottery. It does not make any sense. Thinking, how much money have we made? Well, we've made $300 profit. We've been in a week. Been open a week. You're like, well, we tried. We didn't make millions. Like, no, that's insane. There's so much that goes into changing consumer behavior to include you in their consumption. Do you know how freaking hard it is for an app with millions of dollars behind it, trying to get people to, it's just even a thing they want. So, yeah. So I did 100 episodes, and all along the way, I'm looking for the qualitative feedback, not how many people, but the people that are listening to it. What are they saying? And their response to this work was unlike anything I've ever done. A year into it, I had had a chunk of emails that said, I bawled my eyes out when I listened to this. This episode changed my life. And it was right. The depth of that feedback. It was like, oh, I'm on to something. But it wouldn't have happened if I hadn't made 50 episodes, if I hadn't made 100 episodes. And so anyway, my third point is do project-based experiments that are baked into that, the grit to keep going even when the quantitative metrics aren't working. Grit saying, I'm going to do 100 episodes. Yeah. And then pivot baked in to says, even if it's working 100 episodes, that's when I'm going to say, you know, that's when I'm going to start doing interviews. Cause like, right. Or maybe I did it after like 50 episodes. I thought, all right, you know what? I've done only monologues. I think I'm going to start pivoting a little bit to include some interviews. And right. And we do that, you know, pretty systematically, pretty regularly.
Yeah. I think that's really smart. I do think a lot of projects, you know, this is in the creative space probably primarily, but just across the board, I think people quit sooner when they don't have, like what you're talking about, like this pivot point kind of pre-decided. So if you say, cool, I'm for me with this podcast, basically my deal with myself was I'm going to make 26 episodes in 2021. And my assumption is I will far surpass that. I'm already more than halfway done with that at this point. But the reason why I made that point is because at 26 episodes, now I have a moment to go reflect back, say, is this even fun for me? Do I want to keep doing this? And I made that promise open to everybody who listens to it from the beginning. But I learned that because I've done projects in the past where it's just like, I'm going to start a podcast. And in my silly brain, it's like, cool. And it'll just be awesome forever. But when, you know, once you start hitting the rough patches or when it gets tough, it's just a lot easier to give up. But 100%. If you're like, cool, I just need to push forward until 26. And then like what you're describing too is so important. The qualitative data, like, you know, for me, I described this in a couple episodes back, but, you know, coming from where I'm coming from, my last job, it was just a lot bigger in numbers, in eyes and attention and all these metrics and the numbers, what you're describing. But man, like, you know, it's 10 times bigger back then or in my previous job than what it is in this little project for me. But like, it pales in comparison to the feedback I've gotten on what this podcast has done for people who listen to it. Even just for me being able to connect with somebody else, like the value in way less numbers, but way higher meaning or engagement or connection. Like, if you're okay to give, you know, to maybe give up on the big numbers on the front end, the virality, the desire to be big, a big deal, whatever, however you want to say it, for greater connection and greater meaning in what you're doing, like, I think the long term, it'll just become more and more meaningful. Like, that value will compound over time. And I think you're a great example of this with CPT, Creative Pep Talk. Like, you started, you did 100, and now I know you've climbed and climbed and climbed, and your consistency at chipping away at this thing for years and years and years. Now you're at a very sustainable, very awesome spot with it, where it is probably maybe far surpassed maybe what you thought it might be back in the, you know, when you're recording on your phone while taking walks outside.
Yeah,
I remember those episodes. That's when I first found it and I loved it. But yeah, I guess for the, maybe to close out, I kind of want to pivot. We can take as much time as we want on this, but it's something I haven't explored a ton on this show, but I want to go there with you because you and I have had good talks about it in the past about you've talked a lot in this episode just about meaning and connection. And when you were talking earlier, you know, about the nihilistic framework that a lot of society kind of sees things through right now, of like what matters, nothing matters. And you made a little comment that says, I actually think we do matter a whole lot more than just to each other as like animals or whatever. How, and this is kind of mystical, I know you're kind of a mystical guy. How does the mystical play a role in your life, in your work, in your point of view of the world? Like, where does the mystical live?
That's a great question, man. And I, you know, obviously it's something that is the bedrock of my daily journey, is my connection to what maybe could be called the spiritual side of life. And I want to be very blunt about this. I don't know. I don't know what's going on in the universe. I do not know. And I have been on a 30 plus year journey. And I mean 30, I'm 35. I'll be 35 soon. And I, from when I was little, man, I was asking big questions. I was thinking about, I remember sitting, you know, like on the swing set, 5 years old, and it blowing my mind when I realized, like, oh, my brother is experiencing all of this stuff from his perspective. He's the whole story. His whole story is about him. And I'm thinking, does he even think about the fact that I'm experiencing that? Like, and so I've always, again, that goes back to the why thing, always asking why, always going another layer. Oh, you know, I want to rewind slightly and then go back to what you were saying. I just wanted to comment on, you know, when you said going 26 episodes and saying, do I even enjoy this? You know, or at planning those pivot points, planning those times, you know, one of the reasons I think you got to do that is because you have to bake in being surprised. You know, when I said, I'm not a philosopher. I don't have a degree in philosophy. I'm still learning the basics around the world's philosophy of all time, but I'm very passionate about it. But my brain thinks philosophically. And I didn't know until I got 100, 200 episodes into my podcast that stories are like philosophy in motion. They're trying to prove out thought experiments, right? I didn't know that's what I love to do. All I knew is that I naturally sit around thinking about the meaning of the universe and I'm obsessed with it. And I'm always trying to get another layer of it. I'm always trying to get why. So anyway, I just wanted to rewind and say, part of the reason why you need to go through those 26 episodes, you have to, is just to know, just to learn about yourself. Like you have no idea. Like you don't know what this is. I didn't even know. I couldn't have known that I was a storyteller until in my 30s because I honestly did not know what a story was. And the reason is I think most people don't know what a story is and everybody has different opinions on that. But that's what that process is like. Anyway, I just wanted to rewind to that. And
really
and,
quick, what is a story?
Well, what I think about it is it is a way of mooning truth from your head to your heart. That is what gotcha. It is. And I could go, obviously there's a million other things. A great definition that one of my story heroes I mentioned earlier, Brian McDonald, said is a series of events. That's what it says in the dictionary. His addition is with a conclusion. If it doesn't have a conclusion, it's not a story. And it's not just a series of events. If I sit here and I tell you today, I got up and I drank my coffee and I had a bath and then I did, that's not a story. If I'm sitting you telling you this, you're going to say, why are you telling me this? What's the conclusion? Then it's not a story, right? That comes from Brian McDonald. But that just comes from trying a bunch of stuff, learning a bunch of stuff, digging into it. But from my childhood, the nugget of that, of why I'm a storyteller is I am a person who is obsessed with gathering truth. Truth matters to me. It motivates me. I have to know why. Why are we doing this? If I don't know, the days that I don't have a sense of why we're doing this, I don't get out of bed. They're pretty far, few and far between now because I have a lot of ideas of why we're doing this. But the days that I forget those, I can't get out of bed. And that's an ADHD thing. I need why. I don't just mow the lawn because it's like, oh, I checked that off the box. I'm like, why? Who's coming over? What, you know, like I have to know why. So when you ask about, you know, what is the, why do I believe that we matter even beyond to each other? I will be completely bluntly honest with you. I don't know. I don't have answers. I've spent a lot of time. I grew up in the Christian church. I'm from Indiana and, you know, that was a big part of the culture there. I lived in England for 5 years. It's not a big part of the culture there. I live in Ohio now, so I still live in the Midwest where it's you know, somewhat a part of the culture. And I've spent an incredible amount of time. I spend a lot of part of my week diving into faith, spirituality. I've never been less interested in answers. I don't, and I just don't think we can know what it is, but I do think we can connect to why it is. And I do have some kind of prayer practice that's very hard to put to words, which sounds really cool and mystical, but it's just true. It's hard to explain, but it happens every day. Every morning I take a bath and I try to reconnect to the universe, God, the love, life, whatever that, the creative force that has been pulsing through, making this universe come into being, that I believe is good. I do believe that. I try to connect to that thing. And the funniest thing is there's a big portion of tribalistic religious people from all different parts of the spectrum of religion that are very obsessed with answers. And and I've tried to figure out, like, if I talk to a Christian and they want to talk about, well, are you still a Christian? Do you believe this? Do you believe that? The only way I could describe why those aren't questions I ask are because when I get up in the morning and I try to connect to whatever that good is, those topics never come up.
Right.
The topics that come up are you soaking up the precious years of your kid's life, or are you distracted? Are you spending a lot of your time doing what makes you feel like I'm flowing through you and working through you and doing things in the world through you? Are you positioning yourself on a regular basis to remember what kinds of things feel like, oh, I'm channeling the good? Are you doing those things? Those are the things that always come up. And yeah, I have questions and I am uncomfortable with the lack of answers I have right now.
Yeah.
But that's the most honest answer I could give you.
Sure. I like that. That really resonates with me. You know, I have a faith background as well. And that's just a weird loaded thing in and of itself, but I agree. I've grown to feel sad for people who are very obsessed with answers versus process and experience. And for me, I'm very much at this stage in my faith and in spirituality and all these things where, quite honestly, whatever answers someone tells me, they're going to fall short.
Oh yeah.
And it's always going to, and I think that that's why there's a lot of, you know, pain and struggle and lots of confusion because, you know, religious people or institutions or, and it doesn't even have to be like Christian necessarily. It could be all kinds of things.
Can be anything.
Religion is everywhere. Yeah. It could be social movements.
Fundamentalist of any kind. You could be an atheist fundamentalist. All the people that are sure and certain about their answers.
Exactly. Yeah. Drives me crazy. Anybody who's like 100% certain about anything that no one can be.
Yeah,
I can't. It's just hard for me. But
go ahead.
Yeah, I really like that. And I think you're spot on about, yeah, just being less concerned with the answers to all those big, scary questions and more just like concerned with the present moment because that's all we have. And like, that's all the only thing we can move with. I feel like it has, to use a new age term, I do feel like for you, I've watched, you know, almost mystical things manifest in real time, you know, back even in our working relationship back in the day. I remember we would be talking about an episode or something. And like in our conversation, you'd be like, I just feel something come up like right now. And you would totally like change direction. And it feels like you're just very in tune with this, you know, maybe you were on One Direction for an episode, an idea, we'd be on the phone. And then like in an instant, something hits you where it's not like a practical 10-step type thing. It's just a feeling that comes over you.
Yep.
So you feel like you're really in touch with that whatever.
I think so. And I actually, and I know that sounds like being cocky or something, and I don't always feel like that, but I do think that. I actually think there's something about the neurochemical makeup of my brain. I think it's an ADHD thing too. ADHD people are overly dominant from what I know. I could be wrong about this. Some scientists might be listening. They can correct me. From my understanding, they're overly dominant in the right brain, which is the big picture, lack of details, whatever. And I actually feel like it's almost like I feel like my subconscious is always accessible. Like there's just whatever the deeper part of my brain is, I feel like that's just, it's distracting often, but I feel like, I do feel like there's just something about my brain that is, I need to be connected to that thing. I need to know the meaning and the, what matters to get through the day. It's the only fuel I have. And and being in tune with that is a, it's an obsession every day. Every day I'm spending every single day thinking, how do I make sure, not anxiously, but just like, how do I recenter? How do I what are my practices? What do I do to get back into that place where I'm feeling it and I can sense it and I feel, and I always just have a sense of, does this feel like it's in the flow of what I'm doing on the planet or does it not? And anything that doesn't, you know, Martha Beck, I haven't read this book, but I heard her on the Oprah podcast and she has a book called Integrity that just came out. And that's how I think of it. Integrity, not in the traditional sense, but in the sense of, is there something out of whack with the flow? Mm-hmm. You know, is there a relationship that I know, like I shouldn't be in relationship with this person? It could be a business thing. Could be, you know, I'm always trying and I still have a laundry list of those things at any given time. But last week, even, you know, after months, I was like, you know what? I'm calling these two people and having difficult conversations because I can feel it just like tugging my arm out of the flow all the time. Mm-hmm. So I do think of it and it really freaking sucks. The baggage around spirituality and religion are totally warranted. They are so warranted. It is dicey as hell, these territories. So I get it, but it's a bummer because it is the central thing in my life and it's such a big deal to me. I was gonna, like you, you saying, oh, I feel sorry for the people that are obsessed with answers or I feel when I'm around the people that are obsessed with answers, I when I'm in a religious setting, my whole vibe is like all the people outside of here, you have no idea how much more they know than you.
Right.
And then but the funny thing is when I'm in deeply non-spiritual settings.
Yeah. Deeply secular.
I feel the exact same though. I'm like, you have no idea. Do you know how grateful I am that I spent a good decade on the straight and narrow of religion? I am so grateful. The amount of discipline and behaviors and things that it gave me, tools it gave me, I am like, good Lord, I wish everybody had this because it gave me a foundation that I just don't see a lot in our world with phones and just all the infinite things you can access through that and all that stuff. I'm not perfect. I have tons of like, I still eat too much pizza and, you know, drink too much whiskey from time to time and all that kind of stuff. I'm not perfect in any way, but I'm grateful to have a foundation of some of those things. And I was going to add one other point to all of that, but I don't know what it is, but yeah, the spiritual component I know what I was going to say. One last thing I was going to add to that was, you know, when it comes to knowing the answers, I think that at some point I just felt like, because people know that I am a spiritual person, people know that I have a religious upbringing, I get asked questions like this and I like to talk about it. So there's nothing wrong with it. But I often feel like I come out the other side thinking, well, you didn't have any answers. And I think, and that always kind of bugs me. And also, you know, trying to put the ineffable, trying to F the ineffable, as they say, you always come up short. So you always feel like, I didn't do it justice, man. I didn't say, you know, whatever it is. But the reason I say all that is that one of the reasons I've let go of obsessing over the answers is just saying, you know, I don't know. I love near-death experiences. I love stories of the afterlife. I love dreaming about that. And I, you know what? Again, it's a non-dual kind of like tension of, I also think a really good explanation of what's going to happen after is what was happening before.
Right.
Black, darkness, nothing. You have no consciousness around what you were before you were this. So that it's just as likely that it's that. I don't know. It's not very satisfying of an answer. But what I do think is if and when there is an afterlife, I do know, just I know in the depths of my soul that when I get there, whatever's there is not going to hand me a Scantron and say, okay, right. Tell us what you, what were the answers? Did you figure out what it was? Did you figure out? No, that's not what we're doing here. We're not figuring out what this is. Right. I know that. That's not what we're doing here. We're not figuring out what it is. We're figuring out why. I know that. Why is it? And I believe it's to manifest qualities like love and connection and selflessness and just cool, interesting, the facts that I'm a thing with all these things that the world has never seen. That's just cool. I feel like that's one of the whys. It's like, how freaking beautiful and cool is it that there's this diversity? It's so freaking, I loved X-Men as a kid because there was hundreds of characters. I was just like, that's so cool. That's representative of the truth of life. That when we watch, Blue Planet with David Attenborough, we're like, how freaking cool is this? That every day you could learn about a species you didn't even know that existed. Right. That's the depth of possibility in the universe. That's, and I feel like part of the why is just to the ever expansion of possibility. That even that is incredible. Anyway, so I get really obsessed with the why, and it does bug me that I don't feel like, I feel a little bit, I talk about how when you deconstruct, I think our whole generation is obsessed with deconstruction, whether you're in religious setting, doesn't matter. We're like that about defund the police, take down, to get basically deconstruct the government, deconstruct, just defund, deconstruct all that. Right.
Yeah.
And I think I'm down with that, but I don't think it's sustainable. I don't think we can thrive living in a building site.
Totally.
No home, no structures.
Yeah, totally. Well, you had mentioned Richie Rohr. but he always talks about the deconstruction process being necessary, but my wife's a big Richard Rohr fan and she's told me that he says you can't just deconstruct. You have to reconstruct at a certain 100%. Point as well. And that goes for, it's not just spiritual life. That's everything. But man, I love what you're talking about. And you've really pepped me up. I appreciate you being on. I mean, I think to close out, you have a million things going on. You always do, but maybe just plug what's going on. You just put out this book, what is it?
Pizza? A Pizza with Everything on It. That's definitely the thing. I'll plug three things real quick. Pizza with Everything on It. That's my new kids book. We are pre-orders are just ending, but our first couple weeks of sales that like really matters. So we've been pushing it hard to whether a book really gets out there or has a chance. I am so obsessed with this book and I've made 8 books. I'm proud of all of them. This book is genuinely special. If I was a kid, if I was a 7-year-old and I got this book, I would be like, am I allowed to read this? This is amazing. Like that, it's so goofy and weird. And I think it lets kids in on the joke. Like we're putting a lot of stuff on pizza that we all know as a picture, like kids know the joke is we're not going to eat live penguins.
Right.
So it's funny to do this in a book, right? It's funny to put the White House on a pizza. Nobody's eating it. Nobody's getting hurt. It's a storybook. I'm just really obsessed with it. If you have kids in your life, go check it out. You can go to creativepeptalk.com/pizza and there's the, anywhere you can check out the book. I have a podcast called Creative Pep Talk where I do stuff like what we did today and talk about really about building a thriving creative career, the balance of thriving creatively and thriving in your career, it feels almost impossible, but I actually think there's tons of things we can do to make progress on both those fronts at the same time. That's what that's about. And we also have a podcast network called Co-Loop, and we have a bunch of creative podcasts on there, and you can find those at co-podcast.co. There's like 6 or 7 podcasts. They're all creative podcasts that are kind of in that vein.
Very cool. And as a fan of what you do, Creative Pep Talk, I mean, for me, when I first heard it, I'm definitely one of those guys who it helped shift and change the way I perceive creative work and even just bigger picture thinking. So I appreciate what Creative Pep Talk has been in my life. And yeah, I highly recommend everyone listening, go subscribe, check that out, pick up the book, go check out the other shows on Co-Loop. And Andy, thank you so much for being on, man. This was a lot of fun.
Alex, thank you for having me. This was an amazing start to my week, and I really appreciate all the work you're doing, man.
That was Andy J. Pizza. If you are looking to be inspired every single week, make sure to go listen to Andy's podcast, Creative Pep Talk.
and also pick up his latest book. I promise you will not be disappointed. I'm a huge fan of what Andy's doing, and I am confident that you will find a lot of inspiration just by checking out what he has to say. So thanks again for being on the podcast, Andy. This podcast was produced by the one and only Josh Perez. If you need help with your podcast, Josh is your guy. You can hire him for work at justjoshperez.com, or you can go join his Discord and see which Enneagram number each Harry Potter character is. Thanks again, Josh. If you enjoyed this episode, please head over to Apple Podcasts and leave a 5-star rating and review. And as a new show, the more reviews we can get, the more people can find the show and support it. So thank you so much for doing that. And I will be back soon with another new episode. But until then, thank you for listening to Brave World.